All right, so let's get started. Good morning.
Good morning.
For those of you who I don't know, it's nice to see some familiar faces from my weekly shiur in this building. But for those of you I don't know, my name is Yaakov Danishevsky. I primarily teach at Ida Crown Jewish Academy, as well as I am director of the YU Kollel's Midwest Center for Jewish Learning, which is the branch of adult education in the North Shore. So I want to discuss a really interesting, I think, an interesting topic. I'm very excited about this class. I'm recording.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
it's a new idea I've been thinking about, and I want to just begin by giving credit to the person who stimulated this thought for me. Her name is Mary Rubenstein, so if she listens to the recording, this is just a shout-out to her. But it begins with a question, and the question is the following. There is a distinction always between the substance of something and the form of something. So the simplest example of that, just to go with something very material, is that there's a substance that makes up this shtender, right? And there's the form, right? It became formed as a shtender, as something that is shaped in this way. But we think about things a little bit more conceptually. So we'll talk about eating, right? So you can be eating certain foods. So that's the substance, that's the material you're eating. But there's also a form to the way a person eats. Some people eat very quickly. Some people eat slowly. Some people enjoy sweet food. Some people enjoy spicy food. Those are forms, more form than substance, right? Then let's say you talk about the way a person dresses. So a person, there's the substance, is the actual clothing that a person's wearing. Then there's the form, there's different types of dressers. So regardless of what particular thing they're wearing that day, there's a consistent form and style to the way they dress in general. Or regardless of what specific food they're eating that day, there's a way, there's a form, a style to the way that they generally eat. Does this make sense, the distinction between form and substance? So what I want to pose to you is the following question. We are generally accustomed to thinking about Judaism in the terms of substance. What I mean by that is that we have our Jewish holidays. We have the Chagim, the Moedim. We do Jewish mitzvos, right? We light Hanukkah candles. We eat a Shabbos meal. We daven from a Jewish siddur. Right, we do all these different things that we usually think of Judaism in the form of substances. Those are materials of Judaism. A Jewish text, opening a Jewish sefer, a Jewish book. That's the material. That's easy. My question for you is there something that is the form of Judaism? So that regardless of which Jewish text you're learning, or regardless of which Jewish holiday you're celebrating, is there something that is the style of doing it Jewishly? Is there a form of Judaism? We don't usually think about Judaism in that way. We think about it more in the substance. But has anyone ever thought about this? Is there a form to Judaism? Could you do math Jewishly? Could you study science Jewishly? Can you eat Jewishly, aside from the recipe? Can you bagels and lox? Good. Can you, and just to eat a lot, I guess, right? Can you think Jewishly? Is there a form to Judaism, which would mean that if there is a form to Judaism, you can actually engage that form even when you're doing something that the substance is not necessarily Jewish per se, but you're still doing it Jewishly. Is this making sense? Yeah.
I remember my daughter had a teacher in, I don't know, fourth grade, fifth grade, who said she could teach any subject using Tanakh. Math, science, she could do it using Tanakh.
Okay, so that's interesting, but that again to me is more a substance thing, because then we're talking about Tanakh is a Jewish substance. What I'm wondering is, could you do something Jewishly if there's no material that's Jewish?
What about Ben Adam L'Chaveiro?
Is there a way of interacting Jewishly? Sure, that's a good question.
And different, different, let's say, Nusach Sfard versus Nusach Ashkenaz, would that be considered form?
That's an interesting question. I think that gets a little bit far afield. I think it's an interesting question because I do personally think that there is a slight difference in maybe the type of form that Judaism has taught through different strands of our tradition. Maybe Ashkenaz and Sfard have different forms. That's something to think about, but let's hold off till we get to distinctions and nuances in that way, but that's interesting. So just to formulate this question in a slightly different way, and then we'll get to my suggested answer by the fact that I'm posing this question. Obviously, I think that the answer is yes, there is a form of Judaism, and we'll get to what my suggestion is in that a second. Let me just pose this question in a slightly different way. So I once heard someone point out, and I thought it was an interesting observation, that one way to think about this question is the following. Every tradition aims at creating a certain type of person. like a certain type of personality. So if you would look at a different religion, you would wonder, what type of person is Christianity trying to create, trying to develop? Or what type of person is Buddhism trying to develop? So the question that we want to ask, that I want to ask, is what type of person is Judaism trying to cultivate through all the different substances of Judaism that we engage, through our holidays, through our texts, through our davening, through our learning? But what's the result? What type of person emerges from all of that? You put all these different things together, and then what comes out? What type of person comes out? What was that? A mensch, hopefully. Good. Yes.
That's what I was saying in terms of Ben al-Khaber.
Good. So what comes out? What type of person? So that's a similar question to the first one, just two different ways of asking the same question. So what I want to suggest is the following. Judaism, I think, tries to create a very distinct type of person. It's not exclusively this, but I think there's a heavy emphasis on this. And there is a form to Judaism. What I want to show you is that I think there is a specific form that you find in Jewish thinking from across the spectrum of different types of Jewish thinking. So there are Jewish philosophers, there are Jewish mystics, there's Hasidism, there is existential Jewish thinking, there's all different types of Jewish thinkers that have existed throughout the ages across the world. I want to show you that while they're all very different, there's actually a very common thread in a way that they address questions that is pervasive through all those different styles of thought. Similarly, we have a long history of Judaism, right? Judaism dates way, way, way back, thousands of years. What I want to show you is that across thousands of years, Jewish texts, Jewish thinkers, have engaged thinking about questions in a very similar way, even if they're dealing with different substantive issues. The form of how they deal with those different substantive issues is very similar and a common theme. What I want to suggest is that what is the commonality in the way that Jewish thinkers think across the globe and across history is that Judaism accepts contradictions. We generally think, it's very natural for people to think in binaries. Something is either this way or it's that way. We set up questions as this X contradicts Y. What's the answer? I need a resolution of that contradiction. What Jewish thinkers throughout history have done is addressed questions by saying we can accept the paradoxes. We can live in that space of tension. The Jewish personality, we spoke about what type of personality is supposed to emerge from the Jewish experience. The Jewish personality is one that is able to live in tension, that is able to live in paradox, and doesn't need a black and white resolution of a binary. It's either this way or it's that way. We can accept the gray. We can accept and live in that space where it's not entirely clear. I'll show you what I mean, and I think it'll become more clear as we go. So the first place I want to show you this is, I think, just amazing. The most central text of Jewish tradition, besides from the Torah, is what? Is the Talmud, is the Gemara. So open the source packet to the first page, and we have in front of us the very first page of Talmud. Oh, here. We have in front of us the very first page of Talmud, Masechet Brachot, and if anyone studied Talmud before, the question that all my students ask me constantly that bothers them when they're studying Gemara is, anyone know what's incredibly unique about the text of Gemara? What makes Gemara so unique as a text? Gemara is essentially a legal text for the most part, but what makes it so unique as a legal text? Anyone know? It's filled with contradictions, but okay, let's say even more than that, even more basic than that.
Starts in the middle.
Starts in the middle, okay, and it tries to backtrack, okay? Anything more than that? There are very, very few conclusions. There are almost no conclusions in this massive work. Huge, almost no conclusions. Here and there, we get lucky, we get a conclusion. The Gemara will say, the Hilchata, the Halacha is blank. But it's a legal text that's teaching you how to live without telling you any conclusions. That makes no sense, right? It's kind of absurd if you think about it. This is a text that is teaching you the laws of living, but it doesn't give you any conclusions. Almost the entire text is dedicated to the back and forth of trying to figure out what's going on. So much of the Gemara is dedicated to what's known as the Hava Amina. The Hava Amina is the forethought, what we first thought. And then the Maskana is the conclusion. Very little of Gemara is Maskana. Almost all of Gemara is Havamina. I didn't go to law school, so I admit here that I'm not positive, but my impression is that that is pretty unique for a legal text. A legal text, you would expect to say, here's the case, here's the process of how we address it, how we examine it, and here's the conclusion. Gemara doesn't do that. The Gemara is conversation. The Gemara is an open dialogue. We are brought into the world of the Gemara's dialogue. That's what learning Gemara is. It's the dialogue. And my students will always ask me, so why do I care about the Havamina if it's going to be rejected? Why do I care about this? This is not the... Give me the conclusion. Why are we spending so much time on the answer that we know is about to be rejected? The Gemara gives you phrases to tell you that this answer that we're about to tell you is about to be rejected. So why does it even give it to us in the first place? Right? Like the Gemara will say, V'chi tema. And if you say, and I taught my students, whenever you see V'chi tema, you know what it means is what we're about to say is about to get slammed. So why did we just spend 2 weeks figuring out the V'chi tema and only to be able to reject it? And I said to them, because what the Gemara is trying to teach us is so much deeper than the conclusions. The Gemara is trying to teach us that we live most of our lives in a space of not total certainty. We live most of our lives in a place of questions and doubts. Most things in life are not clear-cut. And that's what the Gemara is trying to teach us. More than the specific conclusions, it's inviting us into that journey of the Hava Amina, of what we first thought, and going back and forth, the open dialogue of having questions and things that are not so clear. And I think about, there's a phrase I like from the world of marketing. You're familiar with this phrase, the message, the medium is the message, right? The medium is the message. Look at this page of Gemara that we're not going to look at any of the details on the page. That's not the important thing for this context right now. But look at the page. This is the medium, right? What's the message of this medium? What does it scream out at you?
Lots of discussion.
Lots of discussion. And look at the page. Look in the middle part is the actual text of the Gemara. The middle part is the actual Talmud. There's no punctuation. There's no breaking up of it. It's the way the text is formatted is screaming out to you confusion. It's screaming at you, we are unclear. You are about to experience something that is confusing. That's what the text looks like. That's what the text feels like. And that's why on the very page of the text, it's flanked by two commentaries who are almost always disagreeing with each other. Because it's saying to you, this is an experience of disagreement. This is an experience of looking at things with nuance and subtlety and seeing things from different perspectives, not getting straightforward, clear-cut answers, this is the law. This is an experience of discovery. And discovery means a lot of open and loose ends. And that's what the text of the Gemara is screaming at us. If you turn the page over, look at the next page on the back side, page 2. This is a picture of a page of Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is the classic body of, the classic text work of literature that came from Rav Yosef Cairo, that came in about the, I think, 16th century. Okay, this is the text that supposedly takes all the confusion from the Gemara, from the Talmud that we just saw on the first page, and tries to codify it for us in clear-cut, simple, tangible answers. This is what you do. Right? Now look at this page. Does this look clear cut to you? How many commentaries are on this one page? So, in the very middle is the Shulchan Aruch, okay? That is the text which is giving you the clear cut bottom line answer. Now, for the most part, the truth is the Shulchan Aruch is fairly clear. It's fairly concise and fairly clear. But Judaism would not allow anything to remain clear for more than 2 seconds. So what happens? What happens? Look at the page. Let's count how many commentaries there are on this little Shulchan Aruch. There is one, two, on the two one, the big ones that are flanking the middle text. Then go to the right side column. So we have one, two, then go to the right side column. 3, 4, 5, 6. I was counting downwards. 6. Then, if you look in the middle, we have these two blocks. So there's 7, 8, and then underneath there, 9, 10, and then 11. So on one page, we have 11 commentaries. On one page, on about 5, 6 lines. And that's just this page. If we would start looking to the back of the book, we'd get more commentaries. We start taking out more books off the bookshelves, we'll get endless commentaries. But we have 11 commentaries who are all in a discussion trying to figure out what's going on in this little middle section. And they're all printed on the same page. Isn't that amazing? Usually, I didn't go to law school, but my impression is usually when I've studied philosophy, when I've studied different areas, when you have different commentaries who are arguing with each other, usually you're looking at two different books. Right? There's this work that's an ancient work, let's say I studied a little bit of philosophy, I didn't go to law school, but a little philosophy. So you're studying an ancient work, let's say by Plato, okay? Or Aristotle, whatever it is. So Aristotle. So Aristotle wrote something way back. Now, when you're studying the different understandings of Aristotle, what you usually have in front of you is a stack of books, because this book has this approach to Aristotle's opinion, and this book has this approach to Aristotle's opinion, and then this book has this approach, and each book is a different approach. But we don't do that in Judaism. It's much messier in the way we do things. We put them all on the same page, right next to each other, so that they're literally screaming at each other. And the confusion is so much greater, and it's so much more unclear. And it's so much more exciting. But why do we do that? Why do we put them all on the same page right next to each other? Because, again, the medium is the message. What this is teaching us is that we're not afraid of contradiction. We're not afraid of disagreement. We're not afraid of the fact that within our one tradition, we will have 11 voices on one single page. Because that's what our tradition is about. It's about engaging that process of looking at one thing in many different ways, and seeing the complexity, seeing the nuance, and not even necessarily walking away 100% sure which of the 11 you think is right. That's the experience of thinking Jewishly.
That's very difficult for teenagers.
Very difficult, yes. Very
but
difficult.
The conclusion is the same, because the Shulchan Aruch is still the Shulchan Aruch, and no matter what all these commentaries are, nothing changed.
So the problem is, so yes, in theory you're right, the problem is that even in the Shulchan Aruch, when you're putting down, when he writes one line, it can be interpreted in endless amounts of ways, within a purview of what actually fits with what he said. But within that spectrum, but within what he said, you can interpret it in different ways, and you can question how it should be applied to a new scenario. Right? The Shulchan Aruch was written, 600 years ago, approximately. So now we have new environments, new things in our world. So depending on how you interpret the Shulchan Aruch, it'll get applied. The same line he said will get applied to our day in a different way. So yes, he has a concise bottom line, and the Shulchan Aruch is, for the most part, the bottom line of our halachic tradition. But there's still so much unclarity. Someone had a hand? Yeah.
So then if someone has a halachic question and they go to a rabbi, I know you have to be very careful, because generally your rabbis will say, I have to consult with my rabbi. You have to worry about who they're consulting with. And which of the sources people are choosing to answer your one, maybe small or large, halakha question.
Right. Yeah, so, yeah. Well, because of the spectrum of opinions is why it's important to have someone that you feel you respect and trust and can identify with, who you can turn to for questions. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but it's you're right, it's challenging for teenagers, and I think that's part of the challenge that Judaism is trying to teach us, is to engage our thinking in a more sophisticated way as we get older, and to continue evolving in that way. So I want to show you some more examples of this. So if you look on page 3, this is a copy of a text from Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik lived in the, 20th century, and he was kind of the powerhouse of Yeshiva University, of modern Orthodoxy, if you will. And he wrote an essay called The Community. And in this essay, he's addressing a specific question. And again, we're not focused right now on the actual substance of the question. What I want to show you is how he addresses and engages the question. Okay, so look at the way he engages the question. We're going to read this together. The Rav writes the following. The very instant we pronounce the word community, we recall by sheer association the ancient controversy between collectivism and individualism. Okay, he's going to explain what that means in a second. Willy-nilly, I can never take myself seriously when I say that phrase, but yes. Willy-nilly, the old problem of who and what comes first, metaphysically, not chronologically. Again, don't worry about specific details here. He uses a lot of big words. I'll explain whatever is necessary for what I want to focus on here. Arises. Is the individual an independent free entity who gives up basic aspects of his sovereignty in order to live within a communal framework? That's one way of looking at society, right? That we have individuals who come from being individuals and give up certain individualistic rights to form a society. Or is the reverse true? The individual is born into the community, which in turn invests him with certain rights. We are born into a society, not as individuals. We're born into a society. The society has chosen to create individual rights in a certain way that then we receive as individuals, which in turn invests him with certain rights. This perennial controversy is still unresolved. This is an age-old philosophical question. Today, the controversy transcends the limits of theoretical debate. People try to resolve it not by propounding theories or by participating in philosophical symposia in the halls of academia, but by resorting to violence and bloodshed in the jungles of Asia and Africa. The political confrontation between the West and East is ipso facto a philosophical encounter between one side of collectivism and one side of individualism. Thereof's trying to suggest, I don't know what was going on exactly at the time he wrote this, but that there was a difference in the sides of the globe in how they addressed this question, basically. Okay, not our focus right now. Here we go, is the part I want to focus on. Let us ask a simple question. What does Judaism say about this conflict? And let us give a simple answer. Judaism rejects both alternatives. Neither theory per se is true. Both experiences, that of aloneness as well as that of togetherness, are inseparable basic elements of the I awareness. As we have indicated before, both the community-related and the lonely individual, be he man, be she woman, were created by God. Hence, it would be absurd to equate the biblical doctrine with either philosophical alternative. The answer to the problem is rather a dialectical one. Namely, man is both. He is a single lonely being, not belonging to any structured collectivity. He is also a thou-related being who coexists in companionship with somebody else. In fact, the greatness of man manifests itself in his inner contradiction, in his dialectical nature, in his being single and unrelated to anyone, as well as in his being thou-related and belonging to a community structure. Whatever you think about this particular question of collectivism versus individualism, what you think that means, the significance of that, not our topic for now, but you see clearly how does Rav Soloveitchik engage. The world is dealing with a philosophical question. What's the Jewish way to address that general global philosophical question? To answer, it's not a binary. It's not one or the other. It's both. And we live with the contradiction. We live with that paradox. We embrace the tension. That's Rav Soloveitchik, a relatively recent thinker. He's considered a more of a philosophical existentialist, if you will, type of Jewish thinker. Now let me show you some other... Well, before I do so, actually, excuse me, turn over to page 4. The Rav writes in a different essay called Majesty and Humility. He writes about this whole topic that we're talking about. He calls it a fancier word, dialectic. Okay, he writes about this. Judaic dialectic, top of page 4, unlike the Hegelian. Okay, so Hegelian dialectic is a famous concept, which is the idea that there's always a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, right? Step 1, 2, and 3. Thesis is the beginning of something. It's the first stage where you have an idea, you have a person, you have something that's happening. And then the antithesis is that which comes and seems to contradict it. And then the synthesis is the final resolution of those two things, which come out in this synthesized version of the thesis and antithesis. Soloveitchik writes the following. Judaic dialectic, unlike the Hegelian, is irreconcilable and hence interminable. Judaism accepted a dialectic consisting only of thesis and antithesis. The third Hegelian stage, that of reconciliation, or what I just called synthesis, is missing. The conflict is final, almost absolute. Rav Soloveitchik writes somewhere else, he says, the only time that Judaism will accept synthesis of our different thesis and antithesis type things, our dialectics, is the Messianic Age. What we're waiting for Mashiach to come is to give us clarity on this entire mess of the world we live in. But in the world we live in, there is no resolution. There is no synthesis. We live in that space of thesis and antithesis. Let me show you another example of this. So that's the Rav. Now, let's go back about 700 years before Rav Soloveitchik lived, and I'll show you that someone else, very famous Jewish thinker, Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, Maimonides, engaged a completely different question, living in a completely different part of the world, at a completely different time, in exactly the same way. There's a famous question that all philosophers were dealing with, which is the contradiction between God's foreknowledge and human free will. Familiar with this problem? If God knows that I'm going to do something, then how is it possible that I can either do it or not do it? And if I have a choice, a genuine choice to either do something or not do something, how is it possible that we say God knew about it ahead of time? So how do you deal with that? There is literature till we could spend the rest of our lives reading literature on that question. The Rambam deals with that question in a very unique way, in what I would call a very Jewish way. Look what the Rambam says. It's a bit of a long source. We'll read through it together quickly. The Rambam in Roman numeral section 2, the Rambam writes the following. This is in Mishneh Torah. The Rambam writes, Shema Tomar. A person might say, a person might ask, V'halo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yodea Kol Ma Sheyihyeh. God knows everything that will be before it is. V'kodem Sheyihyeh Yeda Shezeh Yihyeh Tzadik or Rasha. God knows this person will be righteous. God knows this person will not be righteous. O lo Yeda. Or a person might say, no, God doesn't know. God doesn't know what a person will be. God doesn't know the future. So now he explains what the question is. Im Yeda Sheyihyeh Tzadik. If we say God does know that the person is going to be righteous, so then efshar shelo yihyeh tzadik. It's not possible that the person won't be a tzadik. V'im tomar sheyeda, and if you say no, God does know sheyeh tzadik, that God knows he'll be a tzadik. V'efshar sheyeh rasha, but it's still possible that he will be a rasha, that he'll be not a tzadik, not righteous. Hare lo yeda hadavar alburio. Then that means God doesn't really know. Right? So what's going on here? Either God knows and you have no choice, or God doesn't know and you have choice, but you can't have both. Da, he says, when the third line, second word in the third line, da, you should know. Shetshuvas she'elazu, the answer to this question, arucha me'eretz, mida or chava, is greater than the size of the globe. It's in some poetic language, mina yam, that more vast than the sea. The kama ikarim gedolim vahararim ramim tluyimba, and great principles and important ideas rest on this question. But what do you need to know about the answer, he says. But you have to know the following. Ulahavin and understand. Bedavar zeshani omer. That what I'm about to say. Kvar bi arnu. We already explained the perek sheni mehilchot yisod haTorah. We already explained elsewhere in his work. Shahakarish baruchu eno yodea mideya shehi chutz mimenu. Kibnei Adam. God's knowledge of things is entirely qualitatively different than the way we know things. For God to know something does not resemble what it means for us to know something. And therefore, we can't really understand what it means for God to know something or to know about the future. Shehem vidatam shnayim, because a person and a person's knowledge are two separate things which are joined. Elohu yis'al shmo, but rather when it comes to God, God, vidato, God and his knowledge, echad, is just one. V'ein dato shel adam yechol lahasik davar zeh, we can't really understand that, alborio, with full comprehension. And just like a person cannot understand the truth of the nature of our Creator, Shenemar, as it says in the Torah, Ki lo yirani ha'adam v'chai, because we can't see God, we can't comprehend God, and continue living. Ein koch ba'adam lahasig v'limso dato shel borei hu. We can't understand God's knowledge. Shehanavi Amar, this is the prophets say, Ki lo machshavotai machshavotechem, v'lo darcheichem drachai. Right, my knowledge, my wisdom, God says. Right, my understanding is different than your comprehension, and my ways are different than your ways. V'kevan shekein. Here we go. And since this is the case, ein bo banu koach leida, we cannot understand heich yada hakadosh baruch hu kol habruim v'hamasim. We don't know what it means for God to know everything about this world and the future. Aval neida below suffik, but we know without a doubt, shemase ha'adam biyad ha'adam, that a person has free will to choose what they do. What we do is a volitional act. We have choice about it. Ve'ein ha'kadosh baruch hu moshcho, and God does not determine what we do. Ve'lo gozer loving, doesn't decree what we do. Lasos kach, to do something. Ve'lo mipnei kabbalas hadas belvad, and we don't just know this because of tradition. We don't just know this because of tradition. Ela barayos beruos, through logical proofs. Midivrei hachachma, through philosophy. Mipnei zeh nemar benevuah. And therefore, it says in the prophets, shedan enes ha'adam al masav, a person is held accountable for their actions because they actually had choice over their actions. Kefi masav, based on what they did. Im tov, im ra, whether good or bad. Vizehu ha'ikr shekol divrei nevuah tluyim bo. And this is the principle that nevuah rests on. So what's the Rambam's answer to the question? It's a long-winded paragraph here. The Rambam started with the question, does God know the future, or do we have free will? And they are contradictory. So what is the answer to the question? The answer is, we don't know exactly how to resolve the question. We accept the contradiction. A totally different circumstance, totally different question he's dealing with, but the same way of answering the question. Shifting gears a little bit, when we say Hallel, you know, it's jumped out at me. Hallel is said when? What is the tefillah, the prayer of Hallel, all about? What type of occasion do we say Hallel? on Chagim, at joyous times, right? It's a celebration, right? It's a celebratory prayer that we say. There are two parts of Hallel that personally I don't think fit into Hallel at all. They seem entirely out of place. What are those two parts of Hallel? Ana Hashem Hoshiana. In the middle of this most joyous prayer, we suddenly start screaming out, God save me! And Min HaMeitzar, right? We're talking about being in distress, being in a place of pain. And we call out to God to save us. And then what do we do after that? Right? And then after on Hashem, right back into the joy, right? Hodul Hashem Kitov, right? Baruch Hashem, Baruch Abba B'Shem Hashem, right? Praise, blessing, everything's good, thanksgiving, and it's all joyous again. And we're dancing, singing an upbeat, happy tune. So we start off with all the good things, celebration, upbeat, positivity. All of a sudden, we're in a moment of absolute crisis, crying out to God. And then all of a sudden, we're back in this place of total happiness. Seems very strange, doesn't it? It's a strange procession. It seems like it's almost seamless to go back and forth between joy and distress. And the answer, I think, yeah, go ahead. Exactly, those are the words I was just going to say. Giluber Ada, which means?
Rejoice with trembling.
Rejoice with trembling, right. So we've been talking so far on a more intellectual level about philosophical questions, individualism, collectivism, right, the Talmud's legal tractates, the question of divine foreknowledge versus free will. But Judaism takes the exact same approach when it comes to emotional experiences. Joy, grief, celebration, distress, we just lump them together. We experience them together. We don't say that you have to be in a state of pure bliss and pure happiness or in a place of pure sadness and pain. Sometimes we have those extremes, but very often in life, things are a mixture. Things are not so neatly packaged that it's one or the other. Right? We all know, right? You make a family simcha. It's a time of celebration. It's a joy. It's also a very stressful time. Right, and I think people can often struggle with that. Right? Like, I don't want to be stressed right now. I'm trying to enjoy this. Judaism would teach us, and the truth is that this is actually way ahead of the time in terms of certain more recent psychological approaches. But Judaism would say, it's okay. You can accept the fact that there's stress involved in this celebration. That doesn't negate the celebration. That doesn't get in the way of experiencing the joy at this moment. We can accept both of these things. There's a relatively new, it's about 20 years old, therapeutic approach known as dialectical behavior therapy. And dialectical behavior therapy is basically exactly this. So there's an example that someone gave me to explain what dialectical behavior therapy tries to do. It's much more complicated, and I'm not an expert or trained in it fully, but I'm in school for social work, so I know a little bit about it. For example, let's say someone loses a parent. Okay, someone loses a parent, and on the one hand, they're very sad about it. But let's say they actually had a very negative relationship with that parent. Let's say, God forbid, that they were abused by that parent. Okay, so they're struggling in that moment with a very contradictory feelings. Right? On the one hand, they have a lot of anger towards that parent, and there's a sense of, like, right, of resentment. And on the other hand, there's also a sadness of losing a parent. So people will really struggle with that. How do I process these emotions? What dialectical behavioral therapy says is it's okay not to have one or the other. We don't have to experience things internally in binaries that it's one or the other. I can experience both the sadness and the anger or resentment at the exact same time. Gilu berada, as you said, right? I can rejoice in trembling. And that really is the Jewish approach from ages and ages ago. Hallel that we say is exactly that. We have the joy and the pain intertwined into one prayer. And by doing that, we allow our fuller selves to be brought into life. Right? Because if you say, I can only have joy, I can only have pain, what you're basically doing is cutting away a piece of yourself and saying, I'm not going to engage that part of myself right now. I want to have joy. So the part of me that's stressed, I'm trying to get it out of my head and trying getting rid of it. But when we engage this dialectical approach of accepting the contradiction, the paradox, and living with those different emotions, we're allowing our fullest selves to be present in whatever we're experiencing. There's so much more to say on this topic, but I want to show you a few more examples. In Rosh Hashanah davening, which is actually approaching relatively soon, feels crazy, feels like it was just yesterday Rosh Hashanah, but Rosh Hashanah is actually approaching relatively soon, we say a tefillah. So the question is, how do you depict your relationship with God? What kind of relationship? Parent-child, spouses, king and servant, friends? What's the answer?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Exactly. Yes. And look at the davening in Rosh Hashanah. Hayom haras olam. Right? Today is the day of the birth of the world. Hayom yamin b'mishpat kol yitzurei olamim. Today will stand in judgment all the creations of the world. Im kivanim, im kavadim, if as children or if as servants. Im kivanim, if we are your children, God. Rachameinu kirachim avabanim. Have mercy on us as a parent does on a child. The im kavadim, and if we are your servants. Einenu l'cha tluyos. We are looking to you with eyes of dependency. Until you can bestow your grace upon us and bring our judgment into light. Ayom kadosh, how awesome is this day, how holy is this day. In one tefillah, we incorporate two different, very different, almost contradictory types of relationships that we have with God into one tefillah. We engage God as a parent and we engage God as a king, which are very different relationships. And we incorporate them into one tefillah. And as you said, the answer is yes. We have even more types of relationships. Shir HaShirim is a relationship of two people in love. We have places in Tanakh where we seem to have a relationship with God as friends. There are places in Chazal where we seem to have a relationship with God as our teacher. We have all these different types of relationships. And Judaism says the answer is yes. It's like my Rosh Yeshiva when I was in Yeshiva in Israel once said, he was teaching us that when you learn Gemara, there's two ways to look at things. And he was trying to tell us sometimes both ways are right. So he said, it's like when you're at a wedding and they come and tell you, do you want chicken or meat? He said, his answer is always yes. He wants both, right? So the answer is yes in Judaism. We accept that tension. We accept and live in that place of paradox. Our relationship with God, we see all those different things. I want to show you another really interesting example of this. Two more examples, and we're going to wrap it up with a really, I think, just beautiful poem that drives all this home. There's a fascinating question to me. This is the perennial struggle of my personal life. Open up to all of you a little bit here for a second. Is the struggle between wanting to have a healthy sense of self-esteem and being able to feel whole and good with myself as I am. And on the other hand, by nature, I'm just wired to be a very productivity-oriented person. Like, I want to just get more things done. I want to read more books. That's for me, that's the thing generally. Like, just read. But I want to just get more things done, always be doing more things, taking on more things, all different sorts of stuff. So I'm like a very productivity-oriented person. I want to accomplish more and more. Those two things, if you think about them, are somewhat contradictory, right? Because if I feel the need to grow and to produce more and to accomplish more, what is that saying about myself as I am right now? Saying that I'm lacking something.
You're dissatisfied.
I'm dissatisfied. But having a healthy sense of self-esteem and accepting myself as I am, what does that imply? That I don't need to grow more. I don't need to accomplish more. So there is somewhat of a tension between those two different aspects that I think many, many people are trying to grapple with. Some people are more wired for the productivity side. Some people are more wired for the self-esteem side. But different people in different permutations of the same struggle might have. For me, that's a real struggle.
Those contradictions.
Why not?
Because you look at your self-image and say, part of my self-image is a desire to grow.
Mm-hmm. But if I want it, why do I want to grow though?
It's part of what.
Because I'm lacking.
No, it's not because you're lacking. It's just part of. Because that's part of the nature, right, of being a human being. That you today you're this way, but tomorrow is going to be not because you're lacking. It's just part of. It's part self-fulfillment. I'll take it to that level.
Okay, so different people are different. There's no question about that. I definitely know that I'm not alone in this, but this is definitely, for me, a struggle that way of resolving, it doesn't work for me.
Okay.
That could definitely work for other people. It doesn't work for me. And I don't think I'm the only human being like that. But you're right. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. It's very much an experiential, personal. It's just a subjective thing, right? So the Judaism addresses this question. Judaism addresses this question, and if you look in the bottom of page 4, there is a sefer that I quote here from the Ramchal. The Ramchal lived in the 1700s with Moshe Chaim Lutzato. He was a very, very famous Kabbalist. He wrote. Also, in addition to Kabbalah, he wrote what is considered the most famous and well-known text of Musar, of Jewish self-improvement, known as Mesilas Yesharim, same author. He wrote in one of his more esoteric books, here I'm just going to tell you outside because we're running out of time, he writes that it's an amazing topic for a whole different time, But he writes, the reason that the Jewish people have two matriarchs, Rachel and Leah, is because they each represent a different aspect of self-worth. Rachel was a person who, when Yaakov meets Rachel, what happens? He falls in love with her. He thinks she's beautiful. And he wants to marry her, and he works for 7 years to marry her. Right? It's a choice he makes, and he wants to marry her. Leah is the total opposite of that. Leah is the total opposite, right? Leah, we see in the Torah, is not someone who he's attracted to when he meets her. He doesn't do anything to try and marry her. What happens? He just gets tricked. He's married to her all of a sudden. So they represent two different things. Rachel represents the DNA that we have as human beings, that we earn. We earn our merits, right? We do things to have self-worth, to have others love us, and to earn that love. It's considered conditional love. Ava hatluya bedavar, it's known as in different Jewish texts. Love that depends on something. The relationship depends on something. Leah is the opposite. It's known as ahava she'ena tluya bedavar. It's the love that's not dependent on anything. It's innate. It's inherent. It's just by definition. The love is always there. There's nothing you can do to earn more love, and there's nothing you can do to take away that love. The love is just there. Self-esteem and self-worth through productivity are Rachel and Leah. And the answer that Ramchal says is that we have Rachel and Leah, and we live with both. The answer is, for some people, that it's a paradox. On the one hand, I want to grow, and yes, I feel a lacking of certain things in my life, and I want to produce them. I want to engage them. I want to develop them. And at the same exact time, despite the fact that it might seem contradictory, I also have a healthy sense of accepting myself as I am, in the way that I am, without any of those new things accomplished. Right? That's what the Ramchal says. And it's the exact same form of engaging this question. Okay? Last quick example, and then the poem. There's one last quick example in the world. This is very esoteric, but I'm just going to do it quickly. In the world of Hasidus, there's a major question that is trying to be dealt with. And you'll already know the answer, of course, based on this whole shir. But the question is, in the world of mysticism, everything, don't get too caught up in this right now, we don't have time to get into it, but the idea is that everything really in this world is an illusion. Because everything is godly. Everything emanates from God, and Hashein od milvado, there is nothing but God, is taken literally in the world of mysticism. There is nothing but God. The entire universe we live in is the expression of godliness. It doesn't appear in the, it doesn't exist in the way that it appears to us. That's true scientifically also, right? But from a mystical vantage point, Ein Olam Havada, there's nothing besides God in this world. Everything that exists in our universe is an expression of God. On the other hand, and some religions, some mystical traditions have taken that literally to mean that we reject the idea that we have any existence as it appears to us. All the way to the extreme, right? Everything is just an expression of God. In Hasidus, in Chabad, and there's a book called The Paradoxical Ascent to God by Rachel Elior. It's an amazing book about the theology of Chabad. Addresses this question, and she explains, I'm not going to get into this too much, but as you can see by the title, The Paradoxical Ascent to God, what she explains is that Judaism has approached this by saying, how could we say that everything is just an expression of God? We clearly see that there's physicality in the world. But yet, from the mystical vantage point that they're working, everything's an expression of God. So I'm not really doing it justice right now, but the answer that she talks about, that Chabad suggests, is that we live with that paradox. Okay, so again, you just see in another strand of Jewish thinking, engaging a totally different substantive question, but again in that same way. Now, bringing this all home, the reason I think that this is so deeply important and impactful and relevant is not for all these philosophical questions, but because we all live with different parts of ourselves. And many people try very hard to try and figure out, well, who am I? Which one is right? How do I deal with these different pulls, these different tensions, the different aspects of self? And there's just an absolutely beautiful poem by a woman named Ruth Lewis in a collection of poetry called Memo to Self. It's a beautiful collection of poetry. This is my favorite. I love the entire collection, and this is my favorite poem in the collection. And she writes the following. It's called I. It's funny how people speak of I as one person. I want a large family. I want a career. I don't need pretty things. I'm very happy. I'm frum. Isn't the truth more like 70% of me wants a large family? 10% wants two or three kids? 20% wants none? 90% wants a career? 10% wants to stay home? 80% of me doesn't need pretty things. 20% craves them desperately. I'm 2% happy, 98% in misery. Still, 2% is plenty. And as for being from, don't we pray, unite our hearts to love and fear your name? I guess when people say I, they mean the consensus, the majority. Or maybe it's just me.
What'd you say?
Her name is Ruth Lewis. And the idea is to engage our lives, our thoughts, and our emotions in a more sophisticated way to accept the wholesomeness of ourselves with all the contradictions and all the tensions. Thank you all so much. Thank you.